Something of this sort must be said as a preface to all such matters, that it is necessary for human beings to lay down laws and live according to laws, or else be no different from the wildest of beasts. And the reason is this: no man's nature is by itself adequate both to recognize what is beneficial for human beings in the running of a city, and having recognized it, to possess at every moment both the power and the willingness to act on the best course. For in the first place, it is hard to recognize that the true political craft must concern itself not with the private, but with the common good, for the common good binds cities together, while the private good tears them apart, and that it benefits both the common and the private interest of the two, when the common good is set in order well rather than the private. And second, even if a man should grasp with sufficient mastery that this is how things naturally stand, and should then rule a city with power unaccountable and absolute, he could never remain steadfast in this conviction throughout his life, governing the city with the common good as his guide, and the private good following after it. Rather, his mortal nature will always drive him toward greed and self-interest, fleeing pain without reason and pursuing pleasure, setting both of these ahead of what is more just and better, and, breeding darkness within itself, will in the end fill both itself and the whole city with every evil. Yet if ever a man were born with a nature capable enough, by some divine allotment, to take on this understanding, he would need no laws to rule over him, for no law or ordinance is mightier than knowledge, nor is it right for reason to be subject to anything or a slave to anything, but rather to rule over everything, if indeed it is truly and by nature free. But as things stand, such a nature exists nowhere at all, or only in some small degree, and that is why we must choose the second best thing, order and law, which see and look to what holds for the most part, but are unable to grasp every single case. This has been said for the following reason: we are now about to determine what a person who has wounded another or done some other harm ought to suffer or to pay. And it is easy for anyone, in any case, to raise the fair objection: what do you mean, wounded whom, in what way, and when? For there are countless such particulars, and they differ enormously from one another. To hand all of this over to the courts to decide, or none of it, is equally impossible. There is one thing which must, in every case, necessarily be entrusted to the courts to decide: whether each of these things happened or did not happen. But to leave to them entirely the question of what penalty ought to be imposed, and what an offender in these matters ought to suffer, without the lawgiver himself legislating on all points, great and small, is nearly impossible.
What then is the argument that follows from this?
This, that some matters must be entrusted to the courts, and others must not, but must instead be legislated by the lawgiver himself.
Then which matters must be legislated, and which handed over to the courts to judge?
The most correct thing to say after this would be as follows: in a city where the courts are poor and voiceless, hiding their own opinions and deciding cases behind closed doors, or worse still, when they judge cases not even in silence, but in courts full of uproar, like theaters, shouting their applause and their condemnation of each speaker in turn, a grievous condition tends to afflict the whole city. To legislate for courts of this sort, if one is forced by some necessity to do so, is no happy business, but if one is nonetheless compelled to it, one should entrust to them the setting of penalties only in the very smallest matters, and legislate most things oneself in explicit detail, in case anyone should ever have to legislate for such a constitution. But in whatever city, the courts are established as rightly as possible, and those who are to serve as judges have been well brought up and thoroughly tested and examined, there it is right and good and proper to entrust much of the judging to such judges, deciding what those convicted ought to suffer or pay. So it is no reproach to us now that we do not legislate for our judges on the greatest and most numerous matters, things which even judges of rather poorer education could work out for themselves, and attach to each offense the penalty fitting the suffering and the deed, since we believe that those for whom we are legislating will prove to be judges especially competent in such matters, most things must indeed be entrusted to them. All the same, as we have often said and done in our earlier legislation, it is right, having stated the outline and the general patterns of penalties, to give the judges models, so that they may never step outside the bounds of justice. And that was the most correct approach then, and this same thing must now be done, returning once more to the laws themselves. Let our statute on wounding, then, be laid down as follows. If anyone, intending in his purpose to kill a kinsman, except in the cases the law permits, inflicts a wound, yet proves unable to accomplish the killing, the one who so intended and so wounded does not deserve pity, nor should he be shown any leniency. Rather, he must be forced to stand trial for murder exactly as if he had killed. But out of respect for the fortune that was not wholly evil, and for the guardian spirit who took pity on both him and the wounded man, and turned aside from them the fate that would have made the wound incurable for the one and the sentence and calamity accursed for the other, out of gratitude to this spirit, and not opposing it, we should spare the wounder's life, but let him be exiled for life to a neighboring city, enjoying the full use of his own property. And if he did damage to the wounded man, he must pay compensation to the injured party, the amount to be assessed by whichever court would have judged the case had the man died of the blow, the same court that would have tried it as murder. If a child wounds his parents, or a slave his master, in the same deliberate way, the penalty shall be death. And if a brother wounds a brother or a sister a brother or a sister, in the same way, and is convicted of wounding with forethought, the penalty shall be death. But a wife who wounds her own husband, plotting to kill him, or a husband his wife, shall go into permanent exile. As for their property, if they still have sons or daughters who are children, the guardians shall administer it, and take care of the children as of orphans. But if the children are grown men, the exile shall not be under any obligation to be supported by his offspring, and the offspring shall keep the property themselves. And if anyone who falls into such a misfortune is childless, the relatives, gathering together as far as the children of first cousins on both sides, both through the men and through the women of the exile, shall, after taking counsel with the priests and with the law guardians, appoint an heir to that household, to be the 5,040th household of the city, reasoning in this manner. That none of the 5,040 households belongs to the man living in it, or even to his whole family line, so much as it belongs to the city, both publicly and privately. For the city ought, as far as possible, to keep its own households as holy and as prosperous as it can. Now when a household is struck by misfortune and impiety at once, so that its owner leaves no children behind, dying unmarried, or married but childless, convicted of willful murder, or of some other crime against gods or citizens, for which the law explicitly prescribes death, or going into permanent exile without children, that household must first be purified and ritually cleansed, as the law requires. Then the relatives, together with the guardians of the laws, must meet, as we said just now, and look through the city for whichever family is most highly regarded for virtue, and at the same time fortunate, one in which there are several sons. From that family they should adopt one son for the dead man's father and for the ancestors above him, naming him after them for the sake of the family name, and pray that he prove, as their begetter, hearthkeeper, and tender of their rites both sacred and secular, luckier than the father was. Having made this prayer, they should install him as heir according to law, and let the wrongdoer lie nameless, childless, and without a share, whenever such disasters overtake him. Not everything that exists, it seems, has a boundary that touches directly on another's boundary. Rather, where there is a borderland between two things, that middle ground touches each of the two first and lies between them both. And indeed, among involuntary and voluntary acts, we said that what is done in anger is just such a middle thing. So let this be the rule for wounds inflicted in anger. If a man is convicted, he must first pay double the damage if the wound proves curable and quadruple if it proves incurable. But if the wound is curable yet brings some great and shameful disgrace upon the one wounded, he must pay four times the damage. And whenever a man's wounding of another harms not only the victim but the city as well, by making him unable to help his homeland against enemies, the wrongdoer must, besides his other penalties, pay the city for that harm too. For in addition to his own campaigns, he must serve on campaign in place of the man now unable to serve, and take up that man's post in battle. Or failing to do this, he becomes liable to prosecution, according to law, by anyone who wishes to bring charges of draft evasion. As for the value of the harm, whether it comes to double, triple, or quadruple, the jurors who convict him shall set the amount. And if one member of a family wounds another of the same family in this same way, the kinsmen and relatives on both the women's and the men's side, down to the children of cousins, men and women together, shall meet, judge the case, and hand the offender over to his natural parents for punishment. If the assessment of the penalty is disputed, the male relatives shall have final authority over it. And if they cannot agree, the matter shall finally be left to the guardians of the laws. In cases where children wound parents in this way, the judges must be men over 60 years old who have genuine children of their own, not adopted ones. If someone is convicted, they must decide whether he ought to die or suffer something even worse than death, or something not much lighter. None of the offender's own relatives may serve as judge, even if he has reached the age the law requires. If a slave wounds a free man in anger, his owner must hand the slave over to the wounded man to deal with as he pleases. If the owner does not hand him over, he must himself make good the damage. If the owner claims that the slave and the wounded man conspired together to fake the incident, he may contest the charge. If he fails to prove this, he must pay triple the damages, but if he succeeds, the one who devised the scheme, together with the slave, becomes liable to a charge of kidnapping. Whoever wounds another unintentionally must pay simple damages, for no lawgiver is able to legislate against chance, and jurisdiction shall belong to the same court that was named for children's offenses against parents, and they shall assess the value of the harm. All the wrongs we have described so far involve violence, and every form of assault is likewise violent. Every man, woman, and child must always bear this in mind concerning such matters, that age is honored far more than youth, both among gods and among men who are to be safe and happy. It is a shameful thing, hateful to the gods, for an assault upon an older person to occur in the city at the hands of someone younger. It is fitting for any young man, if struck by an old man, to bear the anger patiently, storing up this honor for himself against his own old age. So let it be thus, let every one of us revere our elders in deed and word. Let a man regard anyone 20 years older than himself, male or female, with the same caution he would show a father or mother, and for the sake of the gods of birth, let him always keep his hands off anyone of an age still capable of begetting or bearing children. In the same way, he must restrain himself from striking a foreigner, whether long resident or newly arrived, whether starting the quarrel or defending himself, let him never dare to correct such a person with blows. But if he thinks some foreigner deserves punishment for behaving insolently and violently toward him, let him seize the man and bring him before the city wardens, but keep himself from striking him, so that the local citizen may be kept far from ever daring to strike a foreigner. The city wardens, once they have taken charge of the case and examined it, being mindful of the god of foreigners, shall, if it appears the foreigner struck the citizen unjustly, give the foreigner as many lashes with the whip as he himself gave, and so put a stop to his foreign insolence. But if he is found not to have done wrong, the accuser shall receive threats and reproaches from them, and both men shall be released. If a man of equal age, or one who has no children, strikes another equal in age, an old man, or a young man, the one struck may defend himself naturally, with bare hands and without a weapon. But if a man over 40 years old dares to fight with anyone, whether as the aggressor or in self-defense, he shall be called boorish, ill-bred, and slavish, and it will be fitting for him to receive a humiliating penalty. If a man is persuaded by such warnings, he will prove easy to guide. But the man who is hard to persuade and pays no heed to the preamble should readily accept the following law. If anyone strikes a person 20 years older than himself or more, then first, whoever happens to be present, provided he is neither the same age nor younger than the combatants, must separate them or be counted a coward under the law. But if he is the same age as the one struck, or younger, he must defend the wronged party as he would a brother, a father, or someone still older. Further, the man who has dared to strike his elder, as described, must stand trial for assault, and if he is convicted, he must be imprisoned for not less than a year. But if the jurors assess a longer term, the time they set shall stand. If a foreigner or a resident alien strikes a person 20 years older than himself or more, the same law shall apply with the same force regarding those present who must help. And whoever loses such a case, if he is a foreigner not permanently settled, must serve 2 years in prison in payment for this offense, while a resident alien who disobeys the laws in this way shall be confined in prison for 3 years, or for whatever longer period the court may fix. Anyone present at any such incident who fails to give the help the law requires must also be fined. The man of the highest property class a mina, the second class 50 drachmas, the third 30, and the fourth 20. The court for such cases shall consist of the generals, the company commanders, the tribal commanders, and the cavalry commanders. Laws, it seems, are made for the sake of decent people, to teach them how they may live together in friendship. But they are also made for those who have escaped education, whose natures are unyielding and untouched by any softening, so that they rush headlong into every kind of wickedness. It is for the sake of these people that the arguments about to be given will be spoken. It is for them that the lawgiver will necessarily legislate, though he wishes there were never any need to use such laws at all. Whoever, in an act of outrage, dares to raise a violent hand against the father or the mother who bore him, or against their parents in turn, without fearing the wrath of the gods above nor the punishments spoken of beneath the earth, but instead, as though he knew what in truth he does not know at all, scorns the ancient and universally attested traditions and breaks the law, needs the harshest possible deterrent. Death is not the harshest thing. The sufferings said to await such people in Hades are harsher still than death. Yet, however truly they are described, they accomplish nothing to deter souls of this kind. Otherwise, there would never arise men bold enough to strike their mothers or commit such unholy assaults against their other parents. It follows that the punishments inflicted here in life for such acts must, as far as possible, fall no short of those in Hades. Let it therefore be declared as follows: whoever, not gripped by madness, dares to strike either parent, or the father or the mother of either of them, must first be met with help from whoever happens to be present, just as in the earlier cases. And the resident alien or foreigner who helps shall be invited to a seat of honor at the public games, while one who fails to help shall be banished from the country forever. The citizen who is not a resident alien shall be praised for helping and blamed for failing to help. A slave who helps shall be set free, but one who fails to help shall receive 100 lashes of the whip, administered by the market officials if the incident occurs in the marketplace, by the city wardens if it occurs elsewhere within the town and the offender is a resident there, and by the officers of the country wardens if it occurs somewhere out in the countryside. If the bystander happens to be a native, whether child, man, or woman, everyone must come to the defense, denouncing the offender as unholy. Anyone who fails to help shall be subject to the curse of Zeus, god of kindred, and of fathers, according to law. If a man is convicted of assaulting his parents, he must first go into permanent exile from the city into the rest of the country and be barred from all the sacred places. And if he does not stay away, the country wardens shall punish him with blows and however else they wish. And if he returns, he shall be put to death. If any free person eats or drinks with such a man, or shares in any other such fellowship with him, or even merely meets and willingly touches him, he must not enter any temple, nor the marketplace, nor the city at all, until he has been purified, considering that he has shared in a cursed fate. If in defiance of the law, someone pollutes the sacred places and the city unlawfully, then whichever official becomes aware of it and fails to bring the offender to justice shall have this counted as one of the gravest charges against him at his official review. And if a slave strikes a free person, whether foreigner or citizen, whoever happens to be present must help, or else pay the prescribed fine according to his property class. Those present, together with the one struck, must bind the slave and hand him over to the injured party, who, taking him, shall bind him in chains and give him as many lashes as he wishes, without harming his master's property thereby, and then hand him back to his owner to keep, according to law. Let the law be this: whoever, being a slave, strikes a free man without the order of the magistrates, his owner, once he receives him bound from the man who was struck, shall keep him in bonds until the slave convinces the man he struck that he has earned the right to live unshackled. The same rules shall hold for women toward one another in all such matters, and for women toward men and men toward women.